Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with Australian actor and comedian Jim Jefferies. The night before Jim Jefferies got in a van to busk his way through the dusty mining towns of Australia's outback, he couldn't sleep. His decision to quit school for a career in stand-up wasn't keeping him awake. It was excitement. He felt like his life was finally about to begin. Roughly 14 years and one viral gun control rant later, he's become one of America's most successful, controversial, and truly unique comics. His comedy specials and short-lived TV series Legit have been called deplorable, profane, highly polarizing, and even un-American. They've also been called bracingly honest, human, and funny. The way Jim sees it, the most patriotic thing any of us can do is speak out against the things we disagree with. What amazes me is how he can turn opinion into biting comedy in seconds, basically writing as he performs. This is a guy who often doesn't plan what he's going to say before he walks on stage. And that's part of what makes him so exciting to watch. I think he gets away with the stuff he says because he points out his own flaws as gleefully as he does everyone else's. In fact, Jim thinks we'd all be more successful if we were more honest, and I think his career is proof of that. Jim is not short on opinions, and you'll hear a lot of them in this episode, along with his advice for aspiring comics, what to expect from his new Comedy Central show, and why he thinks we could all do with a little less positivity. Here's my opinion. Jim's the rare artist who's willing to let people think less of him in service of his comedy. After our conversation, I thought more of him, and I wager you will too. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I discovered you probably fairly late, but I saw someone sent me the gun control bit that you did. And this is a few years ago on your Netflix special, Bear.
That routine actually is 16 and a half minutes long or something like that. And it was originally 22 minutes long. But Netflix, that was the only bit they edited out. They went, this gun thing, why?
You're kidding me.
They said it's too long. No one's going to want to watch anything. And I had to plead. They wanted it down to nine minutes. And I had to plead to let it go to 16.
This is just proof that you really, no one knows your audience better than you.
Well, then in the second, this is also happens with the new TV show we're doing at Comedy Central, but then in the next special, Freedom, I did a bit that went viral on Donald Trump, and they said, oh, don't talk about Trump too much because he won't be relevant soon, and you know, he'll be gone, right? And then we were writing, and I said, I'll do it anyway. And the bit went viral before the election. I actually thought he wouldn't get voted in. I thought, okay, well, that'll be a nice little bit in time. You can watch a stand-up special from the 80s where they talk about Mr. T and you still get what they're talking about, even though Mr. T is not relevant anymore, but you still know what Mr. T is and who he was. And so then we made this news show and they said, well, whatever you do, don't talk about Trump because we're going to make the pilot. The pilot's going to come out in December. It's only going to be seen by test audiences because it's a new show. It'll never be seen. And they go, and by the time people are seeing in December, Trump will be irrelevant. So I did it again. And then while I was writing this whole episode that had nothing to do with Trump, nothing to do with the election, whatever. And I think we were sitting in there in the office with all the writers watching the election like, oh, well, it looks like she'll win Florida. We'll see you all tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
We all walked out of the office and then next day we come in. Oh, we got to write a new episode now. It's going to be around for a while. And it's amazing with the whole Trump thing that people are already saying, oh, you're just going to be Trump bashing, eh? You're just going, well, if you're talking about the news, you got to talk about him. I don't know if we're going to talk about him that week because that week hasn't happened yet. But I assume he's going to do some shit that's going to be some news.
Yeah, well, the reason I brought up the gun control thing at the beginning was I think that once I saw that bit and then I went back and looked at a bunch of your work, I, as an audience member, wouldn't be faulted, I think, for thinking, oh, that gun control bit, that's who he is.
Yeah.
He's a very political commentator. And yet, when we go back and look at
a lot of cock jokes.
Specials and a lot of very personal stories. And
yeah.
For me, there's a bluntness to your work. You start by saying something extremely, extremely direct and blunt and hardline. And then slowly, kind of like social commentary or like a debate thing,
yeah,
you build this bridge.
That's what I always think. I you did debating in high school.
Right.
Where you had to, even if you didn't agree with something, you had to make points.
Is that how you develop that routine?
I look at it like that. Even though I agreed with the points I was making, but I thought I had to make points to argue against people who didn't agree with me. And so, like a debate, I had to do, give examples and so forth and so on. Yeah.
How does that work look? Like, specifically, how do you go about it?
I've never written a joke down. I have no log of my material, apart from the specials, of course, you know, but I've no written log of anything. I have a computer that's really just for Googling things and porn, you know. even writing the
that's
TV.
That's what they're best for.
Even writing the TV show and the sitcoms and stuff, I've written all of them laying on my back. I have a sofa, and I have a person who's a writer assistant who's worked for me for a long time, and she sits there, and I just dictate all the scripts, but I've never actually typed anything. I don't have Word on my computer. I wouldn't know how to structure a script on paper.
So when you're doing, like, say when you're writing the gun control thing, are you working with a writer's assistant?
No.
How does that work?
For the stand-up, I don't write anything down.
So you just sort of, do you do it in the mirror? Do you?
No. I think about it to myself, and then it pops out, and I sometimes think before I go on stage, I might do 2 minutes of that. Or people always around LA are always trying to convince you to, because no one gets paid to do stand-up comedy in LA, and people are always trying to convince you, come down and do my show, and they're promoters, and they're trying to, you know, get you to do it for free, and they go, you can, it's a really loose room, and you can just try out stuff, and I'm always like, fuck that, man, I don't want to try out new material in LA where someone important might be in the audience. I do it in the middle of the show in Kansas.
Right.
My shows are like 2 hours long, and I always try to do 15 minutes or something of new stuff that's going on in my head. But I've never, so the gun thing probably started out as 5 minutes, and then I added a little bit on stage. And you do most of your writing while you're performing. But that routine sort of came out of me arguing in bars with people after Sandy Hook, you know.
Oh, right.
I was on the set of Legit when that happened, and I remember when Sandy Hook happened, and I was with John Ratzenberg, who, Cliff Clavin from Cheers.
Yeah.
And he's Republican. I love the guy. I have no bad words to say, man, but me and him have very different political beliefs, and we got into a little argument about it, and that's where the material started. Just him going, hey, you know, if the teachers had guns, none of this would have happened. Yeah, need more guns, right?
And that's a central theme of the bit is if the teachers had guns. But the amazing thing is how you manage to take each argument that people have made on that side of it, the pro-gun side of it, and sort of break it apart to where at the end, you'd have to be a moron not to agree with you. Like, that's the amazing thing is that I'm already...
Well, a lot of people don't. I got a lot of hate mail.
But it's hard to... Well, and that's the thing.
I think coming at it as an Australian gave me a little bit more levity in the whole thing, because I grew up in a gun-free society. Well, I actually grew up in a society that had guns, but no one really gave a fuck. No one really... I never met anyone that had a gun, but we had similar laws to you. And then we had a big massacre, and then they got rid of them, and then it all, you know, stopped. You know, but so I had that sort of high ground, or whatever you want to call it. And then I lived in Britain, where they've just always been a gun-free society, and no one's ever wanting for a gun. No one's ever like, oh, if only I had a gun, my life would be better. You know, there isn't that. There isn't, but also a very violent society. You know, the British are the only people in the world to use the word glass as a verb. You know, like if you want to get in a good bar brawl and get punched in the face, the UK is the place to do it, but you won't get shot. So that's arguably better.
Yeah, you may lose an eye, but
yeah.
You'll live.
There's a lot of guys with scars like this, you know, but they're all living. So, you know, there's a trade-off.
How did your audience change after that?
Well, my audience got a lot more diverse. I used to comment on how my audience was basically men the same age as me.
Right.
Like people have always, oh, you must meet a lot of girls doing this job. Not at my shows. Not at my shows. The women who were there were with men. You never saw a group of women that were like, oh, let's have a girls' night at a Jim Jefferies show.
Yeah. No, I can understand that.
You know, even now it's quite rare, but it does happen now, you know. And the ages changed, race was more diverse. Everything changed from that sort of moment on. And now the weird thing is I have two sets of fans. I have the fans that want to hear me do some sex jokes or whatever. And then I call them like the Carlin fans, like the people who want me to do some social commentary, right, or what have you. So I like to do both anyway. So I try to please everybody. You know, my theory on stand-up comedy is that you can't write for the audience. You got to write for yourself. I this sounds really wanky, but I think I'm the best comic in the world because I'm writing a show that's directed directly to me, right? I'm writing all the jokes I want to hear. So it's engineered perfectly for my brain because it's my sense of humor. If people walk away from your show and they feel like they know you a little better, I think that's important as a comedian, because there's lots of comedians you watch who are hysterically funny, and then at the end of them, you don't know shit about them. You wouldn't know if they had a family. You wouldn't know about their childhood. You wouldn't know. There's no emotional connection.
When did you discover that the more personal you made it, the more...
Well, I made it. I made it more personal basically because I'm shitty at writing just straight up jokes, you know? And so for years, I mined my childhood. Just, I was ringing up my brothers like, you got any other funny stories that happened to us that you can remember, you know? And I basically, that's all dried up. I can't have another childhood. I've used all those, you know what I mean? So I think I had a kid subconsciously just to fucking mine his childhood, you know?
Well, that brings up a good point, and I think that would be incredibly hard if you've based your whole deal on your own experience.
Well, it's also people get into me now because I think I have changed a bit as a comedian, and you know, a lot of my stories used to be about having one night stands and taking drugs and all the things that I really don't do anymore.
Right.
Well, a lot, you know. so those...
You've cut down.
Yeah, those things, I was a different stage in my life. I think some of my fans would have been happier if I died, like in my mid-30s.
You think?
Yeah, that would have made them happy if there was a bit of mystique. And all that stuff. I think I've outlived my welcome. Yeah. And so now, as you get older and you run out of all the stories, you just become social commentary. You start talking about things. And it does get difficult in the sense that, you know, do you want your social commentators to be poor? Or once you get to a certain stage, like, I'm a guy living in a nice house with a nice car and I'm bitching about the world? Like, really?
Does that create anxiety of what I'm going to write about? Or
I still think I've got enough sort of... working class Australian in me to ride that out for a while.
But yeah.
I'm not apologetic about any success that I've had. I don't think that that's the way to do it either. A lot of people try to sort of still claim that. Look, I really like Louis C.K., but he's always, and in stage, he's always talking about how, oh, my life's not as good as it used to be and everything's a bit shit now. And when I was young, things were good. And now that... No, his life's as good as it's ever been.
As good as anybody's life will ever be.
Yeah, he's fucking crushing it, man. He's crushing it. Like, he's the top of his game. He's hysterical. He's in fucking movies. I don't know how his personal life is with the women or whatever, but I assume it's better than when he was poor.
Yeah,
I assume.
I would guess that.
And so you know, it's very hard to do, like, a lot of my stories now that I do on stage relate to me being around famous people now because I still feel out of place. But I did a private function where I performed for Mariah Carey.
Yeah.
At her house, and Al Pacino and Warren Beatty were there, and Eddie Murphy, and all those. And I was performing stand-up at the end of the dinner table. Like that's the more stories I like, where no matter how popular I get or whatever the money is or something, I'm still a dick. I'm still uncomfortable in these situations. You got to be very careful with telling stories about your personal life where you don't come out as the hero. You always have to be the fall guy in the stories. There's no, you know, in comedy there's no victimless joke. I don't believe there is. I don't believe there's a single joke about. No sitcom has ever been written about a person having a good day. Every TV episode you'll ever watch that's funny is about someone having their worst day. No one's it's ever like, I had a good party and everyone showed up and my friends were great.
Right.
You watch like Curb, it's just every episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm is his miserable day. Or you even watch Friends, every episode is them having a dilemma and not getting along. In Seinfeld, they're all getting dumped or something. It's never about good stuff.
Right.
Comedy's not about good stuff. Comedy's about the shit. It's about the horribleness of life.
I mean, that's sort of the death of art, is comfort, right?
Yes.
I guess that is the Louis C.K. dilemma then, because
he's like me in the sense that I'm sure he doesn't feel comfortable yet either.
Right.
You know what I mean?
What is it about that?
Like, I think that fucking actors do. I think they feel comfortable right away.
You think so?
Well, look, let's be honest about these people. Let's be honest about these people that we give awards to, that we put on a pedestal. Lowest run in the entertainment business. A lot of them are lottery winners, whether it be like being born good looking or whatever. But even the good looking ones don't win the lottery. They keep on winning the lottery, right? It's the most competitive industry in the world. You have to go to college to learn how to fucking do it, right? I would rate actors, and I've got actor friends, and if they watch this right now, they might be angry with me, but just try to act like you're not. There's probably, I would put them, ventriloquists are way above them. Jugglers are way above them.
Ventriloquism is hard. I'll give you that. It's very hard.
Being able to cry on film, not that hard. I did it on my first acting day. Do you want to know how they do it? They blow fucking eucalyptus oil into your eyes. A little machine goes, and your eyes, you just start fucking crying. And then they're like, roll the film. Right? It's not that hard. I'm sure there's people who can do it naturally, but they make your eyes hurt. Yeah, I don't disrespect actors. I just think I sometimes watch the Oscars and just go, oh, God. and like, why is it that a comedy can never win best film?
You're right. A comedy is completely underrated in terms of the skill it takes because...
I'll tell you this about comedians.
Yeah.
Right? Very quick. Okay. You can be a fantastic actor, and I've been to acting classes that with people who are amazing acting teachers, and you can be the best actor in the fucking world, but if your look's not quite right, or if you just go on a couple of bad shows, or you get signed up to, you get typecast or whatever, you may not get your big shot, right? If you're a great stand-up comedian, there isn't a single great stand-up comedian on this planet, like a great one, who hasn't been given their opportunity. That has just been passed by. Not one. Not one. You know, if you're a great comedian, I don't care what a bag of shit you are as a human being, you will have a good income. So, you know, if you're a comedian right now and you're watching this and you're thinking, I've never got my opportunity, you're probably not very good.
So you're saying comedy is the proof's in the pudding.
If you're good at it, you will make money. There's no one going to go, no, we're not going to. If you're good at it, you'll be making a living. Because I have a theory on, this is why actors are short, right? This theory might not work out.
Let's hear it.
This is why actors are short, right? Okay, so if you're not good at sports, if you're good at sports, like really good at sports, you'd never have to develop your personality. You ever met an athlete? They're fucking pieces of shit, right? The most boring human beings you'll ever meet, right? You never have to work on your personality because you're going to get laid. Now, everything in life is about trying to impress women. And we're wired this way that we'll find a woman. That's all it is, you know what I mean? So everything's to try and impress women. So you work on your personality so that a girl will eventually like you. And if you're in school and you're good at sport and you're good looking, girls really like you, right? If you're good looking and tall, you don't even need to be good at anything. If you're really good looking and tall, you don't need to be good at anything. Girls will like you, right? If you're tall, short, fat, whatever, ugly, you better be funny, right? Now, if you're good looking, short, and not funny, so you're not good at sports because you're too short for sports and you're not funny, because they have this theory they look better on camera. It's a load of fucking rubbish. Like Will Ferrell looks great. He's like 6'2 or something like that, right? Now, if you're short and good looking, you better learn a fucking Shakespearean monologue real quick, right? Because that's the only way you're going to get girls to talk to you, by going into the theater class. And that's why they all get into it. That's why all the short fellas are in theater, because they're not the jocks at school. And so they're like, oh, all right, I'm going to do a play.
So
why they get into acting. The short, good-looking fellas all get into acting.
So it begs the question, did you develop being funny? Were you naturally funny?
I have two brothers. One brother's a cop, and he's not funny. He's a very nice fella, but he's not funny. He's never been funny. My mother is maybe the most humorless person I've ever met. I've never seen her say a joke or naturally laugh at something. She acts,
really?
She acts like she's laughing and sort of, but she doesn't know what's going on. She's not funny at all. But she has a presence about her. When she enters the room, everyone stops and feels uncomfortable. So that's something, you know. Like, that's maybe that's where terrible. I got that. Like, no, you got to have presence. Now, my father is hysterically funny, but he has no presence whatsoever, you know. So hopefully I got my mother's sort of ability to hold a room and my father's sense of humor. But my other brother Scott, is arguably funnier than me. When people meet him, they all go, wow, he's way funnier than you.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if he could ever harness it. I don't know if he has the ability to harness
it. Well, what is that? Because that's what I think. I think that people have their days, or people are funny in certain situations.
It's whether you can be funny at 9 p.m. on Friday. Can you do that again for me? And then can you do it again at 11 p.m.?
Is that just hard work, or is it...
No, I think I think it's something you either have or you don't. I think, back to your question about the being funny in school or whatever. I knew very early on in life that I wasn't good at many things, you know, and I accepted that very early, that I wasn't good at sport and I wasn't very smart and I wasn't going to get good grades, and the thing that I enjoyed was being funny. And I used to watch, I imagine the same way that people who are into music, whenever there was a late night show on, they always had a comic like once a week, you know, and the rest of the nights were bands. And I always looked forward to the night the comic was on. And whoever it was, you know, that was the bit that really turned me on at like sort of 12, 13. And then watching Eddie Murphy's Delirious, that really shaped my life. It was the first time I'd seen someone doing stand-up comedy for more than 4 minutes.
Oh, really?
I'd never seen it. I couldn't even fathom that that was a
thing.
So
what did it seem like to you? I mean, here's a guy telling stories and...
Well, he was so young. First of all, he was 20 or something. He was so young. And it was just also him telling stories about his childhood. And I, at the stage, was still a kid, and he was talking about him and his brother in the bathtub and all that time,
right.
and being on welfare, and these things really related to me because I was living that at that stage, you know. And then it was amazing just to hear him say motherfucker over and over, like swear words that Australians didn't even use. And I remember, like, then Beverly Hills Cop came out and being so excited by the idea that someone said the first 3 minutes of that film has more swear words than has ever been fitted into film in 3 minutes, right?
I didn't know that.
Because he's in the back of the truck and the cigarettes and motherfucking cigarettes and the thing.
Right.
He's the motherfucker. And it was like, and I remember like counting out the swear words with my brothers, like how many, like he's still swearing. And just that was blowing my mind.
And you've been out to break that record since.
Well, people, I became synonymous with the word cunt, and I feel like I don't know if I deserve that label, but everyone gets very excited to hear me say cunt these days.
Is that true?
Like it's a catchphrase.
So you go in the airport and people are like, hey, Jim.
People call me cunt all the time as a
really?
Thing of affection. Americans love being able to have this liberty to say it all of a sudden. But it's people come to the show and they take pulls with their friends. They bet on how many times I'll say cunt. And they always
say... Is it a drinking game?
Yeah, well, it's at the end, like, whoever wins the money, and they count out how many times they do it. You know what it was? It was... this is a weird story. So HBO gave me a special. I'm completely unknown in America. So they, on my first special, I swear to God, they said, look, here's the deal. Our show's rated, I think, in 15-minute increments, right? And so... it's not enough to get good ratings. It doesn't matter if you get bad ratings as long as everyone stays. So we want people to tune in and then keep watching. That would be a big compliment because you're unknown. And they didn't spend much on me. I got a very little amount of money.
Right, so it doesn't matter if a low number of people start watching, they just don't want anyone to drop off.
They just don't want any drop off during the show, right? And they go, so here in America, people hate the word that you're saying and like it might make people really dislike you, right? And they go, so if you couldn't say cunt for the first 15 minutes of the show, so if you watch that special, I don't say cunt
for the first 15 minutes,
right? And they had a light at the back of the stage. Now, comedians, when they're on stage, they often have a light to tell them when they're wrapping up, like 5 minutes left or whatever. They had a red light at the back of the theater, and that was my cunt light. and that light came
Jesus.
On. That light came on to say you can now say cunt from this moment on. And like if you watch that special, like 15 minutes, 5 seconds, Aunt Panda's a bunch of cunts was the next sentence that came out of my mouth. It was like that scene in Rocky where he's like, you can switch back to Southpaw, kid. You know what I mean? Like the whole time, like my brain was, don't say cunt. And then, yeah, it changed back. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well,
and now I'm doing a new show, so I won't be saying, I guess they could bleep it. You know, it's Comedy Central, so there is some restrictions on swearing.
Right.
Which, you know, I
we're going to find out if there's restrictions on swearing now.
Well, you say I can say whatever I want, but
well, that's what they tell us.
Yeah, they tell
so
you.
So we'll
this.
See.
You have to bleep cunt out a lot?
I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe we have.
What if I say?
Maybe we need a light.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was one of those things that the next day, that was what everyone was talking about, was that I said cunt on television.
Right.
And everyone was like freaking out, like this guy just. And so the thing they were most worried about was the thing that sort of, I think, made the special kind of popular, because it was just. And I didn't see it as anything.
But you connect it to the Eddie Murphy experience that you had. And of course,
yes,
it's
and
like
the, and kids,
every kid is looking for.
And now that's 8 years ago. And I meet comics who are like 23 and they go, I've been watching you since I was a kid. And I feel really old. I'm like, what? I don't realize that special was like 8 years. I don't see 8 years as a long time, first of all.
Right.
You know, like 6 months to my kid who's four is like fucking.
Well, yeah, it's like a fifth of his life.
He looks at photos. He goes, do you remember when I was like that? I go, yeah, I do.
It's last Tuesday.
Yeah. I took him. So we had the new billboard for the show and I pick him up from school and I said, we're going to go drive along Sunset. There's a billboard I want you to see. And there's so many hundreds of billboards we're driving by. And he's like, is that one, Dad? I said, no. You'll know it when you see it. Trust me, there's a special billboard coming up and you'll know it when you see it. And we kept driving and there it was. It all appeared. There's billboards either side of it. And I said, what do you think of that? And my son went, a new Minions movie? Like the next one. He goes, new Minions movie's coming out. I said, no, that billboard. He goes, oh, yeah, that's you, Dad. But look, there's a new Minions movie. He didn't even see that as a thing. And then he was telling his mum.
He's telling his mum
the next day. He's like, yeah, Dad took me to see the new Minions billboard. That's got to be good.
Yeah, he said I'd know it when I saw it.
Yeah,
I did.
As soon as he saw it, he went, oh, yeah, I see what you're taking me for, Dad. New Minions movie.
Well, talking about that idea of getting a reaction from saying something, you said, I read something you said where you felt one of your special powers was the fact that you can say pretty terrible things and be likable.
Yeah,
When did you discover that?
Well, I still don't know what that quality is. I know other people who have it as well, and I've talked to them about it, and there is something about being able to say really offensive things and not upsetting something. And I don't know, I thought it was going to go away in my 30s because I thought it was all about me being baby-faced in my 20s.
You can get away with it.
Yeah,
he's
I thought
cute,
people
were
like,
innocent.
He's a kid, he's got an accent, don't worry about him, right? And then it didn't go away. I think I don't know what it is, but that is something that I'm very happy that I have, that I can say really horrible shit.
You're like an old man that gets away with looking at boobs.
Yeah, exactly.
He's going to say, give the old guy a break.
My dad has that quality as well. My dad's, every time I brought a girlfriend home from the age of about sort of 16 onwards, my dad's been a little bit fucking dirty old man and no one cares. They all love him. They're all like, oh, your dad's all right. He's a little bit of an old perv, my dad. We used to watch, my dad can't figure out the internet. And so he knows there's porn in there, but he can't get to it. He doesn't know how to get to it, but he's heard the rumors about all the porn in there. So he still watches movies that might have a bit of tit in them. That's like a big thing for him. Oh, there's going to be some tits in this film.
Right, he'll sit through just about anything.
That Scott Baio Zapped film was on constant, like during my childhood, that one where he could just pull girls' tops down with his brain, which is super rapey, but it was a film about that, right? Anyway, so me and my brothers figured out that Dad was, you know, the dirty old man. We knew this from the moment we were kids, but we'd be watching a movie like Labyrinth, right? And we'd be watching it, and me and my brothers would all sort of look at each other, and towards the sort of beginning of the film, we'd go, oh, wow, look at those tits, right? Like we'd seen some naked tits. My dad would come out of the woodwork. We don't know where he would be in the house. He'd just go, what are you kids watching? What are we watching? Then he'd sit and watch the whole film, a G-rated film about puppets. And he'd be like, how how is there tits in this film? And then he would go...
Rewind it.
And then that's what happened. We'd go, we'd finish, we'd go out to play, and my dad would go, I didn't catch the beginning of the film. Just put the film on to the beginning. And he'd be bemused to why he had to watch this whole movie.
Just messing with your dad.
Yeah, just cheap little... He had like four porno magazines in the garage.
From like 78.
Oh, the 70s, yeah. Yeah. Like big bush fucking... Like permed hair porn.
You know, there was a kid in my neighborhood who could come over. Like, we would get in big trouble if we said anything, any bad words or anything. But this kid could come over and tell a story to my mom, and he could cuss up a storm, and she would think he was so charming. He was a terrible dude, but but everybody
Eddie
loved
Haskell.
Him. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I made a conscious effort now. I just swear in front of anybody. Don't worry.
Yeah, was there a point where you discovered there was no repercussions?
If you just become unapologetic about it, people just accept you for you. It takes it's like when you get a new girlfriend, and there's that first fart that you do in front of them, and it's a test fart, right? and you do that first fart, and she goes, I can't believe you did that in front of me, and you go. Yeah, but you weren't that upset. You know what I mean? And by the end of the week, you're just farting whenever you want to fart, right? So people just, even that at my kids' school, I just swear in front of the other parents. I don't do it in front of the kids, but I just fucking, I don't care.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then sooner or later, people just see you as like this sort of, almost like an eccentric person who can't help themselves. I don't see swearing as a rude thing. I don't mind swearing. I think I have a tendency to be a rude person, I try to stop that. Like when I'm in shops, like occasionally a friend or a girlfriend or something like that will tell me. When I go into shops, sometimes I just go like this. I'm like, how much this mug? Like in my brain, right? And I don't understand I'm being rude, but in my brain I'm going, excuse me, kind sir, I was wondering if you would tell me how much to purchase this mug would be. Like I think I'm being super polite. And then I'm like, thank you. But I'm like, how much mug? And then I'm like, And then I just walk
That's
out.
That's too much.
Yeah.
What are you?
I don't know I'm being rude. I got a little bit of the spectrum on me. I'm a little bit, and I don't know those social things where you're meant to talk to people. And also, I've worked by myself for so long. I've been self-employed since I was 23 years old, just by myself. I never really had to interact with people. I was by myself the whole time.
Well, in Freedom, you mentioned that you found out through your son's vaccination process that you were on the spectrum, and that was
I found out that I had some... They diagnosed me with attention deficit disorder in school, and I don't think I ever had that personally. And I am dyslexic. There's no two ways about that. That's a fact. You know, but I do have little things about me that I sometimes don't notice when people are upset. I very rarely make eye contact with people. And I even now, like every now and then I'm consciously going, make eye contact again. And then I phase off. And I realize...
That's going on in your head
right
now.
Yeah, and I really realize this when I was acting, and every time they were doing my shot this way, and so you're not meant to look down camera, you're meant to look past the camera, and they always put a bit of tape on the wall when the other actor isn't with you. So the other actor might be giving lines here, but they put a bit of tape on the wall, so you go, that's where your eye line is. And then they kept on going, you're not looking at the tape. And I'm like, I wouldn't look in their fucking eyes if... When you're in the scene together, it's fine, but like, just had to stare back at the tape. I was feeling uncomfortable staring back at the tape. And so I don't understand these people who just keep eye contact the entire time through a conversation. It seems very uncomfortable to me. And so, you know, and I'm sure other people in my life, as I said, I told people that they diagnosed me with mild, and everybody's like, oh yeah, that sounds about
right. That makes
sense. That's about right. But I don't know if I do. I think people are different. I think people have their own personality traits. I think there's... some people are awkward. Now, there's obviously people who have complete Asperger's who, sure. You know, there's no question about it. But I think some people, we're all just wired a little bit differently, and that's how things work, you know. I think there's part of the reason I can't take in information if it's written down for me. I can only visually take in things. And I can only remember something if I record it like through a voicemail or something like that. If I write it down, it won't mean anything to me, you know.
That's
the same thing with remembering the jokes. I've got this theory on, people always ask me, have you ever forgotten a routine? And the answer to that is, how would I know?
Yeah, I guess.
You know what I mean?
Like, because
I don't know what I've forgotten.
Right.
I've forgotten it, right? But I have a theory that it keeps you fresh, that, you know, I know how long the show's meant to run, and if I run out of things to say, then I know I've recorded like 7 hours of stuff, and so I couldn't perform any of that anymore.
Right.
You know, it's very often, just before I walk out on stage, I'm like, I don't even know what I'm going to talk about. And then once you're
Does that ever scare you?
No. No,
it's really?
Only, you know what I do? And it's happened a few times, not many times. I just tell the audience, I go, I can't think of anything to say right now. Give me a moment. And then I got something.
And then it comes.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to pretend.
Try to pretend, keep talking and just doing crowd work and stuff like that. People respect that if you just go, oh, no, I got something now. Yeah, it's fine. I think I would never take, like, there's a few comics who take a pad up with them. I think that ruins a bit of magic if you're checking or you pull out a bit of paper and you check. I think that ruins it. I think if you've got an obvious, a lot of people have a set list taped to a box or something, or even
right.
writing on their hand or something like that. I think it all takes away from it. I think that'll, you know, necessity is the mother of all invention. I think that'll take away from those moments when you are in the weeds, when you just have to think of something funny to say.
And that keeps you sharp.
Yeah, it keeps you sharp. Yeah, for me personally, it might not work for other people, but for me, the panic is a good thing.
Hearing you talk about your parents being so opposite,
yeah.
and you finding out you're a bit on the spectrum and not making eye contact, and then hearing that you don't write anything down, it's almost like
Rain Man.
It's like two opposite questions. Number yeah. one, where did you ever get the confidence to think you could be a comedian? And number two, was there anything else you could be?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think there's anything else I could be successfully. I don't think I could definitely not work that anything involved a computer or a desk or a real
right,
job.
Right.
Yeah. The way I found out I could do it was okay. So I did three spots when I was 17, which I very rarely talk about. I did one show at the Sydney Comedy Store.
When you were 17.
I was 17. I went down.
How do you even get that opportunity?
Well, I just kept on putting my name on a list to do the open mic night. And all these comics used to show up, and they used to just draw out of a hat the people who would be on.
Okay.
So 30, 40 people would show up to do open mic nights, and like seven would get selected. And I went down like two or three times, and then the third time I got on. And I went down there, and I had it was like magic. I did this 5 minutes, and I killed. And it was like so easy. And they said, okay, come back again and do it in two more weeks. So I come back in 2 weeks, but they said, you got to bring a parent or some guardian figure, an uncle or something.
Okay.
Because you're 17. I wasn't even allowed in the bar. I lied about my age and, you know, I just fessed up. And so I said to my dad, I said, Dad, this is what I've been doing, right? I kept it all secret. I said, if you could come down with me, I got to do it again. I think I'm really good at this. So I took my dad back, and it was Sydney has really, if it rains, it fucking pours, like hailstones and stuff. We drove out in the pouring rain, the wipers, and we go out, and then maybe 10 people showed up, and they were the 10 people who wanted to get on the show themselves. So it was all just amateur comics just sitting in the room. And I went on stage, and my father was sitting in the room on the second time, and I not just like little laughs, like zero laughs, people talking, and just me talking. I was 17, so I was talking about like a girl I liked in high school, or whatever, you know, I was trying to talk about politics or whatever this dumb kid would fucking talk about, right? And nothing. And because also these older guys and girls that wanted to do comedy, they probably resented a 17-year-old getting up and giving it a go.
Right.
And so they weren't giving me any love, and it was humiliating. And my father saw it, and it was maybe one of the lowest feelings I've ever had in my life. My dad we got back in the car, and my dad was he said something along the lines of, he goes, oh, look, you're good at lots of things. He goes, if this is a hobby that you enjoy, fine, but I wouldn't, you know, don't put too much into this.
So he saw a bad night. He saw you bomb.
Yeah,
and he missed the week before.
Yeah, he missed the week before. And then I thought maybe that one. And so the low was the lowest I'd ever felt. And so it's the same as any drugs. The high when you first start taking heroin is amazing, and then the come down is terrible. And then like everything sort of plateaus, you know, as you go through this, until the highs aren't that high and the lows aren't that low. You're just doing it to feel normal. And now I do stand-up comedy to feel normal, because I'm so used to doing it all the time that I wouldn't know what to do with myself if I didn't do it.
That's now, so fascinating.
So the next show I did, I went and gave it one more go by myself. I found another pub that had an open mic night. So I went and gave it one more go, and it didn't go great either. It wasn't as bad as the second show, but it wasn't anything to write home about. And obviously I wasn't ready, you know, but I sort of went, all right, that first one was a fluke, and I'm no good at this. Anyway, I stopped thinking about being a stand-up comedian, and I go off to university. I'm still interested in being in the arts, and I auditioned to do a musical theatre course at the Western Australian Academy of Performing Arts. Now, this audition, they auditioned like 2,000 people, and there's 20 spots. And so I just went it because my grades weren't good enough to get into college. And I went along, and I sang a song, and I did a monologue, and I got in. Right, I turned out I was a singer all of a sudden, right?
And I
got in there. This is the same course that Hugh Jackman did. He studied musical theatre at this. It was like a government-funded full scholarship. And I went to this school, and it was just like being in Fame. There's girls just limbering up everywhere to do dance classes. There was ballerinas in a certain course and opera singers in a certain course. And I was like, it was 10 guys and 10 girls, and the girls were just like the best looking girls I'd ever seen, you know. And all the guys, 8 of them were gay. It was just me and another fellow. I was in heaven. And I wasn't a very popular kid in school. And I thought, now I'd met a whole lot of like-minded people who wanted to be entertainers and all that type of stuff. And I thought, this is great. I could do this, you know. Anyway, it turned out I wasn't particularly good in comparison to these other kids who had been singing their whole lives and dance classes. And I didn't have to do a dance audition. I was uncoordinated. I wasn't particularly good, but just like in high school, every year we'd put on a musical, 2 of them, you know? And so we'd do the musicals, and every year I'd be given the comedy role. And every year I'd fucking steal the show by being really funny. And I wasn't the best singer, and I wasn't the best dancer. I definitely wasn't the best actor, but I was getting all the laughs. And then they'd put me in a couple of serious roles because they wanted to shift everyone around so you could work different muscles. You could put me in the most serious role, I was still getting the most laughs in the whole thing. And I wasn't trying, and sometimes I was embarrassed by it. Sometimes I'm like, I'm trying to do a romantic scene here, and people in the room were laughing. And I went, I guess I'm just fucking funny, I don't, you know. So I went and started doing open mic nights around Perth. But very quickly, I became like the best guy in town.
Right? Really?
Yeah, I had like a following after a couple of months. All the people at college were coming out to see me and stuff like that. And I did what a lot of comedians do. I opened up my own room where I could MC every night. And the problem was I couldn't book anyone, but I would just get on stage and I would just do as much stand-up as I could. And once a week, I'd run my own gig. And then I booked a biggish comedian. Like, I thought he was a big star at the time, but just the guy who'd been on TV once or twice in Australia.
Right.
And I booked him, and I got him $200 together for the gig. And I thought, this guy was like it. Anyway, he said, I'm going to go do some of the gold mines all through Western Australia, where all these towns that there's 9 men to every 1 woman, you know, and they're just fucking blokes who have been down a hole all day who have a shitload of disposable income because they work in the mining industry and they have no entertainment. So you just rock up to, you didn't even book the gigs, you just rocked up to bars like, hey, how about we perform here tonight and we'll just go in the corner there and you'll just pass a hat around at the end. And we'll see how much money we can make.
Basically.
Yeah, basically bust. And so I went with this guy, and he said I could be his opening act, and he'd pay me $50 for each show that I did with him. I'd be his opening act, you know. So I went out to all these gold mining things, and I saw that as, and looking back on it, that was just busking. But I looked back on it like, this is an opportunity that's too big for me in my life to pass up. And I quit college.
It did. Yeah. So you quit comedy
to go
found college, and then found out you actually that was like you almost missed what you were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I almost missed. And so I was still in the field of entertainment, but I wasn't in the right area. And so I thought busking in the outback was a huge opportunity that I just couldn't pass up. You know, so and also sitting on a sitting in a van with professional comedians talking about comedy, you know. I remember the day before we left, because there was another comic on the show as well, that we went out, three of us. I remember I couldn't sleep. I was so excited that my life was about to start that I couldn't sleep.
Did like you know at that point, like, that's what
I didn't
you're meant
tell
to
my
do.
Parents. I dropped out of college. I didn't say anything. My parents were dead. My father not so much, because my father likes comedy. My mother was dead against me doing it for a job.
You know, and I took away from as like the whole of your career was that you were willing to let people think less of you in service of your comedy.
Yeah, I don't. I work on the theory that hopefully, if you lose one or two fans, you pick up three. By being honest,
and just
telling your truth and all that type of stuff. I don't think, you know, I don't have any respect for a person like Michael Jordan, who would never be political, and he was the biggest star in the world at one stage, and he never fucking said anything because, in his words, Republicans and Democrats both buy sneakers.
Right.
Right? And it's not a Republican or a Democrat thing. Occasionally you have to speak up. He was a black man around. Ronnie King was happening. Didn't say fucking shit because, what, your sneaker fucking empire, you cunt?
It gives you a lot of respect for Muhammad Ali, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And
person
20
who takes
years earlier
stance.
Was much, much harder.
Yeah, and a guy who said, I won't go to war, I won't do this, I'm a Muslim, fucking put his balls on the line. And then at the end, fucking the utmost respect almost from everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, even John Lennon, like, they were going to deport the guy. You know, they had, the FBI was tapping his phones, all because he was saying we should all love each other, we should all get along, and they said that's not good, so they blocked his green card. And, you know, he still kept on saying that this is the right thing. Now, whether you agree with him or not, at the time, he was seen as this beatnik fucking troublemaker, and no one thinks of John Lennon like that now.
No.
And like, and there's things about him that actually helped him. He wasn't even a great fucking dad or a husband or a, you know what I mean? There was plenty of flaws about the guy. And I think I still love John Lennon. And I think that's another thing that you can do as a person. Show your flaws, because we all have them. To dress yourself up as someone who's fucking perfect and squeaky clean, just show your warts and show like your faults and show stupid shit you've done. You know, I've gone through a breakup and I'm separated from the mother of my child, and we still get along, we're still best friends and everything like that, but I will talk about the things that I did wrong that led up to that decision. I'm not gonna live my life like I'm fucking Ryan Seacrest, just smiling in front of a camera, telling everybody that things are super. Because in fucking 100 years, no one's gonna know who the fuck Ryan Seacrest was. You know,
that's right.
Everyone who's watching you has flaws. You know, they have them as well. You got to just show them. It's really important, because if you dress yourself up as something you're not, you're lying constantly. I look at it now, like, there's probably some sex tapes of mine out there where I've been doing shit, and probably pictures of me doing illegal, like, I don't know, right? If they come out, it won't be good, but I don't think anyone's going to condemn me, because I'll just go, ah.
Well, you're the eccentric guy.
No. I've already fessed up to so much shit. I've already fessed up to so many things. You know, it's very, to stand on stage and to talk openly about things that you've done that many people, whether it's using a sex toy or drugs or one night stands or any infidelities that you've caused. And the fact is, my mother will see that. There's no hiding from it. My mother will see it. And you watch these stupid things where they talk about people being type A and type B, and I think people are much more complex than that. And everyone always goes, everybody's like an iceberg. You only see this little tiny bit at the top, and 90% of it's like, well, I'm not. There's about 10% underwater that I keep sort of quiet, and the rest of it I've been pretty honest about. I think that's how someone like Howard Stern got popular. I think the power of being that honest is, if more people did, maybe more people would be successful, more people would forgive you for shit. You know, also, when you're that honest, I think you also show up your good qualities at the same time. You don't just show your bad qualities.
I think that is the hallmark of your show, Legit, by creating a character that was so deplorable in so many ways.
Well, this is the thing. I didn't think he was a terrible guy, but everyone always I was telling stories from life, and when I read the reviews and they go, oh, he's playing this horrible person, I thought I was playing a slightly better version of myself.
Well,
but I thought fundamentally he was a guy that still took care of his friends. That was, you know, I don't know. I'm not going to say something like maybe that show was before its time or something stupid like that. I'm not going to say that. I do think not enough people watched it to sort of get it, and I don't regret how it was. It was a show about friendship and love and treating everybody the same.
Yes, and that's the thing. I think you don't see this much truth on television and in our narrative stories. There's in episode 2 of the first season, your friend, played by DJ Qualls, yeah, and DJ, who has muscular dystrophy and is a quadriplegic, he wants to kill himself, and you're looking for him, and you stop this guy in a wheelchair with only one arm, and you start telling him that when you were young, all you did was you wanted one comedy show. You wanted to get on stage once and see if you could do it, and then that made you want more. And you say this really depressing thing, which is, it's the dreams that create these expectations that crush your spirit, and you end up by saying to this guy, you don't know how lucky you have it. And it's one of those moments on television where here's a guy walking around with all his health telling a Vietnam vet with one arm and can't walk in a wheelchair that he's so lucky.
Yeah.
And yet, as an audience, I sit there and I go, there's a truth to that.
Well, I think... social media and celebrities, mostly actors, have a lot to answer for, because I'm inundated with clips of the power of positive thought. If I have to see fucking Jim Carrey give one more commencement speech where he talks about, and my father, he could have been a comedian, but he was an accountant and he went to work every day. And my father got fired from a job that he hated. And I thought to myself, if you get fired from a job that you hate, why not do something that you love? And everyone just, comments underneath like, this is so... No, that's not an inspiring speech, because it's from a person who fucking made it.
Right.
I want to hear from the person who gave up everything to become an actor and is just a bum now, just like, yeah, I gave up that law degree I hated. I'm glad I followed my dreams. Like, if I have to watch fucking Denzel Washington on TV tell me the power of positive thought. Stop. Successful people shouldn't be telling us about how to become successful. We should have cautionary tales from failures. We're talking about a whole lot of people like, I just pictured it and it happened. Yeah, well, what about the person who pictured it and didn't? They went mad, didn't they? They lost their brain and they went mad. So I think the secret to life is not this whole I have to make it. It's trying to find contentment. It's trying to be happy with your lot in life. You know, chase the dream, not the competition, is the most important thing I can tell any young comedian. If you worry for a second about what the guy next to you is doing, it's going to eat you up.
It's going to destroy whatever joy you can find from what you're doing.
So this new show I've got now,
which is called The Jim Jefferies Show, and it's on Comedy Central.
Yeah, it's a news-based show, and people keep telling me, like, how will you be different from John Oliver and Samantha Bee and all that sort of stuff? And the answer is, I don't fucking know. It will be me. That'll be the difference, because I'm not them. And the show's going to have a slightly more world theme to it. We're doing world-filled pieces and stuff like that. But I'm going to go into it like I've gone into my stand-up. I'm not going to edit myself. I'm going to try to be as blunt with every opinion that I have. I'll live or die by my opinions. You might agree with some of them, and you may not agree with most of them, but hopefully it'll be compelling enough that you keep watching. Now, if you don't, and you decide that you don't want to see me on TV, the public will tell me very quickly, and I'll just go back to doing stand-up, and I'll be all right. But if you want to worry about fucking what the other shows are doing and what their ratings are and stuff like that, that'll drive you crazy. Because there's never a ceiling. There's never a moment. I'm sure Sacha Baron Cohen thinks, wow, that Will Ferrell's doing really good. You know what I mean? I'm sure Brad Pitt and George Clooney have a rivalry where they think, maybe I should be doing that film or whatever.
It never ends, is what you're saying.
It never ends. It never, ever ends until you're fucking on your deathbed and you're more concerned about how much morphine have I got next to that cunt laying next to me.
And that's your last thought, and then you die unhappy.
Yeah.
Well, when you sort of sat down and started to envision this show, what did you not want it to be?
I didn't want it to be a lecture.
Okay.
That was important. I wanted it to be more of a think piece, and I feel like some of those other shows are a little bit more, here's the facts, here's the stats, here's what. And what I like about, say, the gun control routine was it was a common sense think piece. There wasn't a load of statistics in there. And I want to do something where I'm really just giving my opinions on stuff. So I report the news and then give my opinion. I'm not just going to report it and put jokes in it, which is what a lot of people do. Now, that's really the big difference between comedy and standard news shows. So the other news readers shouldn't be, they should be impartial. They should just be giving you the news. And then also, news shouldn't offer solutions, but comedy can. You can actually say in comedy, and this is how I think we should fix it. Where news readers don't actually say that. Anderson Cooper never thinks that. You might ask a reporter, how should we fix this? I'll never ask anyone. I'll just tell you how I think we should fix it.
Well, that makes me excited to see the show, because I don't think there's a lot of people that have the confidence to say, well, I'll just sort of state my opinion in the moment.
Yeah.
That's scary, right? I mean, is there some trepidation about that? The thing is,
I know that just... stating your opinion in the moment means there's a high chance that many times I'll be way off the mark and wrong. But I'm also not afraid that if that happens where we say something where in 2 weeks' time I go, oh, fuck, I shouldn't have said that. Maybe that wasn't the right thing to say. I think I'll just go, yeah, I did say that. I was wrong about that.
Yeah, and you know, what is so wrong about that?
Yeah, just go, yeah, I didn't have all the information. I think I was wrong about that, actually. I do a thing now, I think when, right up until sort of 25, I think I was, I won't say a compulsive liar, but I lied a lot, just through my teens, because I was always trying, I didn't really like myself, and, you know, so I think as at parties, I was always just bullshitting about shit, and then as my life got more interesting, and I didn't need to lie, or whatever, and then as you get older, you just, what's the point, because lies mean that you have to have more lies to keep up with the lies. And so I got to the stage where I try to not lie anymore. Even in my relationships, if I get caught doing something stupid, I fess up real quick. I don't go through the lying phase anymore if I get caught. I used to try to weasel my way out. But now if I find myself lying at parties to someone, if I'm telling a story that's a little bit elaborate, that because on stage you lie a lot, you know, you elaborate stories to make them better and stuff like that. They're all true stories, but sometimes they can be embellished by anywhere between 2 and 80%, depending on how big.
Two and 80.
Yeah. Like the embellishment, and normally the embellishment rate's around sort of 15%. You know, bits added on here and there. But when you're doing, you forget that you can't do that at a party, just talking to a person. Now you're just bullshitting one-on-one. You don't have the guides of, it's a show. And so now, if I'm talking to someone, I've only been doing this for about 2 years. If I'm lying, just halfway through, I just go, I'm lying. I gotta stop myself. And they almost thank you. They're like, oh, well, thank you for telling the truth. And you're like, yeah, well, I am now, but I wasn't before. So sorry about that. It's weird. Just do it once. It's weird the reaction you'll get. It's very off-putting for people.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you talk about this idea of actually being that honest person that is often a thing in movies or TV shows. There's that person who is just totally honest, but no one does it.
Yeah, well, you try to do it, but you know what it was? It was like my son lies all the time, right? Like, because he's a kid, and he's always like, where did that thing go? Oh, I don't know. You know what I mean? And he's always like, oh, mum said that you should give me a cookie. Like, he's dumb, you know, he's a kid, right? So it's those type of lies. And that's when I started seeing it in him. I'm like, wow, we lie from the moment, and he's a good kid, but we lie from the moment we're born. Our instinct is to get what we want.
Oh, did you brush your teeth?
Yep. our instinct is to get what we want in the quickest, easiest way possible. And it's bred into us from the moment we leave the womb.
But what you're saying is there's a whole
I'm trying to teach another human being not to do that when I was as guilty as anyone.
Well, listen, I admire the fact that I feel like I'm sitting across from a human who's not thinking about their brand and what they can say to make themselves more palatable or likable. And I think that those are the artists I'm always drawn to, is people where I feel like, whether it's true or not, I feel like there's a human that I am connecting to, and that maybe by watching what they do and listening to what they have to say, or whatever art it is they make, I can find more of my own experience in them.
Well, thank you.
That's why I wanted to have you on this, because I'm watching someone who's willing to like be themselves and fail and succeed on their own terms. And so
thank you.
I admire that.
That's very sweet. Thank you.
Yeah. So thanks for doing this.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Hey folks, that concludes our expletive-laden show for today. I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you'll go check out Jim Jeffries' work, not only his stand-up specials, but also check out his TV series Legit, and then tune in to his new show, The Jim Jeffries Show. Thanks to the off-camera staff, Crawford, Nate, Laura, Michaela, Justin, Amy, Kara, and Matt. For all their hard work on the show. And if you want to send me an email, I'm sam@offcamera.com. You can find us on social media, Off Camera Show at Twitter and Instagram. And I'm Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. So drop us a line. Tell us what you think of the show. And listen, you do not want to miss next week when I sit down with legendary actor Sam Elliott.
My dad died thinking I was a total idiot for wanting to be an actor. He said, you got a snowball's chance in hell of having a fucking career in that town. I never thought about it as having a need to prove something to him other than I wanted him to be proud of me. I knew that he was in other areas. He knew I could catch more trout than he or any of his friends. But I don't think he ever got the theater arts interest.
You'll hear tales of the Old West, Old Hollywood, new roles, and how it feels to be busier than ever after 4 decades in the business. He also shares what it's like to be the hero of his new film. That would be the hero. It's a role that was written just for him, and one I don't think anyone else could have played. Sam's a straight shooter, and it's gotten him in hot water once or twice, but he's made a career of being honest, on screen and off. Our conversation was no exception. See you next time, off camera.